been on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind him switching sides and standing up for things.
This is unfortunately slow internet here.
They believe in when they're running down our countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life or fighting in it, fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy that claims that he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living.
I have to apologize. The feed here is really slow with the internet, but this is, of course, Merle Haggard's The Fighting Side of Me.
When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life or fighting in a fortune died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song that I'm singing be a warning.
Again, must apologize for the very slow internet connection here for our musical feed. Of course, our signature song, Merle Haggard's The Fighting Side of Me. This is Paul Fromm.
Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. From time to time, I'm going to be playing some clips of this comic. He's a person who's in some ways ruined his mainstream career because of a couple of politically incorrect comments. And in these insane times of witch hunts and so on against the politically incorrect people, the price of a comment that some people take exception to, I won't even say a wrong comment, just a comment that some people may not like, the price has to be your ruination. And so this man has lost a lot of musical gigs and so on, and all by way of punishment because of being politically incorrect. And there will come a time when the people who've done this in our society will have to be punished. And it's very important that we, all of us, rally around people who are under attack. It's not an option to say, oh, thank goodness it's not me, I'll just be quiet. No. You know, if more people rallied around people under attack, the threat of the attack would be a great deal less. But one of the fears of a person who finds himself under attack is that he's without allies. Suddenly, his friends don't know him anymore. He now has enemies he never had. He never knew he had, and people who once were associated with him will come forth with stories to smear him, partly out of opportunism, perhaps, but partly also a way of building a firewall around themselves. See, if I denounce him, I was once close to him, but if I denounce him, I'll be able to show that I'm a good guy. It's a very disgusting characteristic. Well, I'm going to have to hold off on that for a moment because, as I've apologized before, we have a very, very slow feed. You want a good sex story? Well, here it is. Here's one. Religious head urged to take responsibility after independent probe finds Shambhala leader was involved in sexual misconduct. Group's board asked for him to acknowledge his actions. Now, Shambhala is a weird form of Buddhism. It's something of a cult around somebody named Sakyong Nyipham Rinpoche. Anyway, the Sakyong has apparently being rather handy in a way that he probably should not be. The head of one of the largest Buddhist organizations in the Western world is being asked to, quote, take responsibility for the harm he has caused and, quote, express true sympathy for allegedly having inappropriate sexual conducts with Shambhala followers. The International Organization's Governing Council made the request a couple days ago, that's on Sunday, as it released the findings of an independent investigator hired to probe dozens of allegations of sexual assault and misconduct against influential Shambhala leaders. These are the accusations, not just against the head of the outfit, this Sakyong, but other leaders, including its spiritual director, Nyipham Rinpoche, whose title Sakyong roughly translates as king. So anyway, King Rinpoche. Based in Halifax, that's Nova Scotia, in Atlanta, Canada, and Boulder, Colorado, the Sakyong directs more than 150 meditation centers with more than 14,000 people who follow the practice, which aims toward a path of enlightenment. Named Osel Mukpo at birth, the Sakyong inherited his position in 1995 when he was in his early 30s. He is publicly admitted to having fumbled with unhealthy power dynamics and alcohol. What does that mean? Well, I'll leave it to your imagination. The organization's board is urging him to take responsibility for the pain he has caused. Quote, we feel strongly that Sakyong Nyipham Rinpoche should work to find a path toward forward to carry his acknowledgement of these past actions in a way that reflects the honesty and bravery that are the hallmarks of the Shambhala teachings, the board wrote. It's our strong wish that he express true sympathy and speak from his heart on how he will proceed. Now, as much as I get a bit of a kick out of this, I've got to say that the members of his, whatever it is, group, cult, whatever, are a little bit more compassionate than the Democrats and, of course, the organized Negroes throughout the United States and in Virginia, you know, at least in the official talking heads on TV, in terms of the governor, the Democratic governor, who's a leftist, Northam, was alleged to have been one of two characters in a photo from his medical school's 1985 yearbook. One person in the photo is in blackface, the other is in a Ku Klux Klan robe. Well, of course, they can't both be him. But first of all, he apologized. Then he said the next day, that Saturday, he said, well, he didn't really do it. It wasn't he. I don't pretend to know what the truth is, and frankly, I don't care. One of the things that interested me Friday night is that there was virtually nobody I won't say nobody, but virtually nobody was prepared to let him apologize, say these were different times. I was immature, or I was drunk, or I reconsidered my views, etc. Or it was just a prank. You know, college kids do a lot of things that that are not serious. Anyway, there was virtually no compassion. Opportunistic Republicans baying for his blood. Democrats saying he just had lost the moral credibility to continue. He's saying that after people like the Clintons. Come on, moral credibility, give me a break. Anyway, I do find the reaction of this, I don't want to be unkind and call it a cult, but sort of stream of Buddhism, to be relatively fair. They're saying he apparently has made some big mistakes in the past. May have let the power go to his head, and they want him to acknowledge those mistakes, take responsibility. Well, fair enough. And attempt to express some compassion for those people who he's hurt. Well, that too is rather relatively healthy. Rather than get him, drive him out of public life, ruin him. The sex allegations date in some cases as far back as the 1980s. News of the allegations splintered the Shambhala community last year. The allegations were released in a series of reports by a former Shambhala student, Andrea Wynn. She's not obviously not Oriental. And retired Laurel Karen Murchison, who titled their effort Buddhist Project Sunshine. The allegations they investigated related to incidents in Canada, the United States, and South America. there's more how the investigation was done. The investigator expressed the certainty that Sakyong did engage in sexual misconduct on at least one occasion. A woman who attended the daughter's birthday party reported being kissed and groped by the Sakyong, who was intoxicated and unsteady on his feet. The claimant had not specifically consented to kissing, and Sakyong, kissing the Sakyong, that's the king or whatever he was, or to his alleged request to see her breast. It turns out, at least according to the investigator, that many of the allegations could not be proved. So I've got to say, I find the response relatively healthy. Still on the subject of sex, although I'm not, well, believe me, I'm not obsessed, but Weekend Globe and Mail, I'm sorry, not my Weekend Globe and Mail, Monday Globe and Mail, had an obituary, and for once it wasn't a Jew. It's been one of my complaints about the Globe and Mail's feature obituaries, is that at least 20% of them are Jews. Well, Canada's population is less than 1% Jewish. And I think there's an inordinate concentration on them. But anyway, this person's not Jewish. This is Kim Bok Dong. And if the name does not immediately ring a bell, let me inform you. Sex slave from Second World War demanded justice. Kim Bok Dong, a former sex slave, prostitute, or maybe forced prostitute. For the Japanese military during the Second World War, whose tireless campaigning helped bring international attention to the suffering that thousands of women like her endured, died on January 28th in Seoul. She was 92. Miss Kim had cancer. Yoon Min-Yang, president of the Korean Council for Justice and Remembrance, an advocacy group for the South Korean women who were forced to work in Japanese brothels, announced her death at Severance Hospital on Tuesday last. Since the early 1990s, Ms. Kim has been a prominent representative of the former sex, if they were indeed sex slaves, who were known euphemistically as comfort women. She was one of the first to break decades of silence and talk about what had been done to her, and she traveled around the world to testify about it, including at the United Nations. To her last day, she demanded reparations from Japan. When reporters visited her in the hospital, she accused Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government of refusing to atone properly. Historians say as many as 200,000 girls from Korea and other Asian nations were forced or lured into sexual slavery during the war. Quote, the last audible word she uttered before she died was actually a swear word that expressed her strong anger at the Japanese government. In other words, she wanted to shake the Japanese government down. Now, some I've got a take on this. An interesting aspect of this is that Kim Dong actually didn't come forth until after 65. In other words, after she retired. When she did that at first, her own sisters disowned her. In other words, she said, if you trace back, she was in 1945, she'd have been 20. She alleges she had been a prostitute or a comfort woman or a sex slave, depending on your interpretation, for 6 years. That actually started when she was 14. Anyway, let's. I only go through this because I think it's important to go through allegations, as we certainly see in terms of the Holocaust. Kim Bok-dong was born in Yangsan, a small Korean town, on April 19, 1926, the fourth of six daughters. Japan then ruled Korea as its colony. When Miss Kim turned 14, Japan was at war in China. She was conscripted by Japanese officials who told her she would work in a garment factory and that her family would suffer if she refused, as she said in numerous interviews. But she was forced instead to have sex with Japanese soldiers at the military brothels in China and later in Hong Kong, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore until the Second World War was over in 1945. Now, one of the things I find fascinating in this is that notice that her life as a comfort woman or prostitute was over at age 20. She allegedly did this from age 14 to 20, but not just in one place. She was originally sent to China, but ended up also in Malaysia, in what are now what was now Indonesia, what was then the Dutch East Indies, in Hong Kong and the Philippines. I've heard from Japanese that this is a, like the so-called Holocaust, is a story that, well, let's just say, gets more horrific with each retelling. There may have been women who were lured into or forced into prostitution. But what we seem to be have described are what are called camp followers, women who follow the army from place to place, and their role, and they're paid. You know, they're not slaves. They are paid as prostitution. I'm not defending prostitution, but that's the way of the world, and has been as long as we've been aware of armies. The Romans had them. The Greeks had them. The Egyptians had them. Obviously, the Japanese had them. Now, I can certainly go along with the idea that war is hell. Girls get lured into things that may be greater than they'd expected. But I think a sensible approach, and this is one that has been put to me by people I know in Japan, is that many of these women were prostitutes. And they actually earned, for the time, good money. It's not something we applaud. We don't say that's a good thing or good for them. But it's war, and bad things happen. It sounds also like well into only after basically her working life was over did she decide to get on this bandwagon. She was not the first, but she was one of the early ones and start trying to shake the Japanese government down for big money. Perhaps puts a slightly different shine on things. I want to thank my friend in Edmonton, Gilles, for sending this item my way, which has suddenly disappeared off the screen, but we will find it. And it has to do with a man who is a good friend of mine, a very holy man, a very brave man, and that's Bishop Richard Williamson. And we are really having our trouble tonight. Anyway, we'll get this for you. And Bishop Williamson was convicted some years ago in Germany for comments he made questioning the so-called Holocaust. Did he make the comments in Germany? He made them in Sweden in an interview with Swedish television. European court rules Bishop Williamson guilty of hate speech for denying the Holocaust. And this is a report from the Daily Mail in Britain, a report from the 31st of January. British Catholic bishop who denied the Nazis used gas chambers during a TV interview in Germany loses hate speech conviction appeal. I'm sorry, he did do it while he was in Germany, but he was doing it, I believe, with Swedish TV. The European Court of Human Rights has ruled Germany was within its rights to convict British Bishop Richard Williamson of Holocaust denial. Mr. Bishop Williamson, 78, sparked an outcry in 2008 by denying that the Nazis used gas chambers during the systematic murder of the allegedly 6 million Jews during World War II. His lawyer tried to argue he should not have been convicted because the comment was made during a television interview broadcast in Sweden, where Holocaust denial is not illegal. But the interview was recorded in Germany, where it's a criminal offense to dispute the mass murder of Jews by the National Socialists. Bishop Williamson was convicted. The article says Mr. Williamson. Now, usually they give the official title, and he's a bishop. Was convicted of incitement to hatred and ordered to pay a 12,000 euro, that's about £10,000 or about a $15,000 fine, which was reduced to 1,800 euros or $2,400 in 2013 after a series of legal challenges. The European Court said it found no reason to disagree with the German ruling that Bishop Williamson's denial and downplaying of the genocide perpetrated against the Jews had disparaged the dignity of the Jewish survivors. The victims, rather. It pointed out that Bishop Williamson knew his comments were illegal in Germany and confirmed that since the interview was recorded there, it was legal to prosecute the case in that country. He did not seek to make special arrangements to ensure that the interview would not be available beyond Sweden. Well, how can you in the age of the internet? You can't. And would have been aware that it would have been accessible elsewhere via satellite TV and the internet. It was agreed. Bishop Williamson was formerly a member of the ultra-conservative Society of St. Pius X, but it was kicked out in 2012 for disobeying orders from his superiors. Basically, he was kicked out by Bishop Fillet, who was responding, even though they are a breakaway group from the Vatican, to pressure from the Vatican, which then was militantly in favor of suppressing any questioning of the so-called Holocaust. There are people who say that the mainstream Vatican, especially under Paul II, before the former Pope, the Polish Pope, and the present one, who's even worse, basically, when the Jewish lobby says jump, they ask how high. He was excommunicated by the Vatican in 1988 after he was ordained by traditionalist Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre against papal orders. He was allowed back into the church in 2009 as part of a movement by then Pope Benedict to heal a rift between the Vatican and the traditionalists. That decision came days after the airing of Bishop Williamson's Holocaust questioning a Swedish interview. An embarrassed Vatican said it had not been aware of the comments. Bishop Williamson was excommunicated for a second time in 2015 after he's consecrated a new bishop in Brazil, despite not being authorized to do so. Well, this is internal church politics. But what's the this disgrace here. Well, the disgrace here is the upholding by the European Court of Germany's notorious Section 130 of its criminal code, which doesn't actually mention the so-called Holocaust, but does outlaw racial incitement of the masses. Now, many people would argue that the questioning the Holocaust has nothing to do about race. It has everything to do about an alleged historical event or an account of historical events. Let's be quite clear. The European Union is no friend of freedom of speech. And they see no problem with selective prosecutions of people who have dissident views. Even so high-profile a person as Bishop Williamson. And probably the only reason that he stayed out of jail was his prominence. And yes, playing the German system, he eventually got his lawyers eventually got the sentence reduced to a more modest fine. But that's not the point. This is an evil law, and what has happened is that we have a Europe. In fact, a political elite in Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and most of Europe who have a new religion. Most, not all, but most scoff at Christianity. They may not officially scoff at it, but much of our political elite, heavily influenced by cultural Marxism and Zionism, mock Christianity. And if they pay any lip service to it, is only Christianity that does nothing or does very little. That may not be quite the case in the United States, but it's the case certainly in Europe, where much of the political establishment, your Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, Theresa May, despite the fact she's a parson's daughter, have little use for Christianity. Their religion, though, and it's interesting, when you abandon one religion, there's something about people that they want to adopt another one. You replace one set of beliefs, you reject it. It's hard to believe in nothing. Well, arch conspirators have come along and answer the needs of these people. These people are the devotees of a new religion. It's the religion of Holocaust. Now, so some people might say, "But no, that's it's not a religion. It's a view of history." I disagree. The characteristic of a religion is that it's irrational. Now, I'm not saying that to be critical. Religion is a different type of belief from scientific belief. I believe in gravity, not because somebody told me, but I've been told what it is, and I have been shown what it is, and I can prove it for myself. For instance, I can take this cup of tea that I'm holding right now, and I can drop it. It wouldn't be a good idea. I'll get it all over my lap or on the floor, but I know it will fall. I know the cup will fall because of gravity. Well, that's one type of knowledge. That's a scientific knowledge or mathematical knowledge. But there's another type of knowledge, and that's faith. Now, religion, I suggest, is irrational. You cannot come to the belief that Jesus Christ is Lord, is God, by reason. You can't reason to it. You must believe as an act of faith, or not. But you can't reason to it. In fact, when you get down to it, so much of the new religion of Holocaust are acts of faith in utter defiance of reason. For instance, one of the easiest ways to approach it is one of the tenets of the new religion of Holocaust is that what happened to Jews under National Socialism was the worst crime in all of human history. Well, okay, what would worst mean? Well, that's our greatest crime. Well, it would have to do with numbers, wouldn't it? If I say that this was the greatest season for our team ever, we won the greatest number of games. It would mean that we won more games than we did last year or the year before or any year before that, right? I mean, greatest means anything. Well, if this is the greatest crime in human history, and let's not argue about the 6 million, even though the Red Cross said about 250,000 Jews died of all causes in the German internment camps. But, okay, let's take 6 million. Well, in the 20th century alone, 8 to 10 million Ukrainians, mostly peasants, were deliberately starved to death in 1932-33 by the communist regime in Russia by way of trying to break their resistance to collective farming. Well, if my math, 8 or 10 are greater than 6. Or Mao is reliably reported to have killed, either by incompetent famine or mass murder, over 66 million of his fellow Chinese. Well, once again, 66 is bigger, certainly bigger than 6, right? So, if you believe in the new religion of Holocaust, if you actually say that, you're talking nonsense. I mean, far more nonsensical than anything one might be asked to believe in religion, in most religions. In most religions, you may have to make an act of faith. But here I have to just talk nonsense. And it's perhaps not surprising when a religion is irrational, very irrational, like the religion of the Holocaust, that the only way it can be enforced is, that's right, you make it illegal to challenge it. And that's what's going on. That's why in Germany it's a criminal offense to deny or even minimize the so-called Holocaust. And that's a pretty clear ding dong to tell you that maybe it isn't exactly as we're told. Now, what Bishop Williamson said was not something that he came up with on his own, but extensive research by people like Fred Leuchter, who was a specialist in machines or apparatus used for executions in the United States. He was an expert, and Ernst Sundel in 1988 funded a trip by Fred Leuchter and a videographer whom I know and several other people to surreptitiously get into Auschwitz and test the soil and the site around what were called the gas chambers. And his report was that they could not possibly have been used for killing. They were in fact delousing areas to suppress lice and other vermin that would sweep through an area where people were packed together or concentrated and could very well lead to major health or disease outbreaks. What is particularly pernicious about the religion of Holocaust? Now, I don't have a problem with any group having its own take on history. And that will be a take where they will, of course, glorify themselves and make them the center of the story. Well, that makes sense. It's their story. And we'll probably highlight, maybe even exaggerate their sufferings and highlight and perhaps exaggerate their triumphs and victories. And that's not a problem. Have you ever heard much about Albanian history? Whom do they celebrate? Whom do they curse? What did they suffer? In fact, Albania was conquered by the Turks. And it was a suppressed and oppressed by the Turks almost up to just about the First World War. Well, I know almost nothing of Albanian history, and I suspect you do. You don't know much either. What do Albanians believe? Well, I don't know. And I don't care. I mean, it's their history, and they're entitled. The problem with the Holocaust tale is that it is imposed upon us. If Jews want to trade stories about how hard done by they were and how they suffered and that's their business, and it's no concern of mine. However, the diabolical thing about the new religion of Holocaust is it's not primarily a religion for Jews. It's not primarily their history, or at least the history of their time in the Germany and the Eastern Europe in the 1930s and 40s. But it's something we are required to believe. You see, you're not required to believe. You probably don't even know anything about Albanian history. But you're not going to lose your job if you're a little skeptical about some claim an Albanian co-worker of yours makes. And I have known people from other countries. In one case, this was a woman we did some work with some years ago, and she was almost a figure of fun in our group, because according to her, and I don't want to embarrass any particular East European nationality, but according to her, well, just about every discovery, including the great Nikola Tesla, who was widely believed to be Serbian, almost every cultural or scientific discovery happened to come from this one small nation in Eastern Europe. And in fact, her claims were smiled on. She was a great nationalist, and that's a wonderful thing. It's always great to try to boast about your people. But the difference is between her and the new religion of Holocaust was none of us had to believe it or applaud it. And if we disagreed with it, none of us faced going to jail or being fined, like Monica Schaefer did, was in Germany. She was 10 months in jail. Her brother Alfred is doing 3 years and 2 months for exactly the same thing, questioning the new religion of Holocaust. And that is my objection to the whole Holocaust story. I wouldn't care whether the truth was 6 million or, as is far more likely, 250,000. Not all of them murdered. Many of these people who simply died from a number of causes. I wouldn't care. If I were not forced to believe it, or at least pretend I believe it, or, let's say, be very careful not to say you don't believe it. You see, the new religion of Holocaust is being used as a control mechanism, a guilt mechanism. And here's the weird thing about it. Here's where we come back to the irrational. Not just in Germany. At least one might say, well, Germany is the one that allegedly did the Holocaust. That's true. But what about the rest of Europe? And of course, even with Germany, we're talking about 74 years ago. There are very few Germans today that were even alive 74 years ago, or let's say were alive and had any power. You know, they were children. Why should they be held responsible? It's past history. But it gets even weirder. Much of the West also is supposed to be part of this guilt. And this is what I mean about the irrational. Wait a sec, you know, popular history has it that we, in Canada and the United States and Britain and Australia and so on, fought the guys who allegedly committed the so-called Holocaust. Well, why should we feel guilty? We're the good guys. Well, no, that's not the way the story goes. We should all feel guilty. And the so-called Holocaust is a means of people control. Pure and simple. And that's why I object to it. And I object to being dragooned into accepting the another group's history. They can believe whatever they like. Just don't insist that I believe it or that I pay lip service to it. I'm going to take my musical break right now and hope we can get this going a little bit better than some of our previous efforts. This is the very beautiful Rhonda Vincent. She primarily bluegrass, When the Grass Grows Over Me. This is Rhonda Vincent, and I hope we can get this up here on the screen and working for us. I do have a very slow internet connection tonight, and I hope you will bear with me. This is Rhonda Vincent, When the Grass Grows Over Me.
Over me, yes, I. rose over me.
That's Ron Vincent, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Here's a song by Merle Haggard and Connie Smith, A Place to Fall to Pieces. And, she did so many great duets. She has done, I should say, many great duets over the years, and so has, we will not get the one we want. This is a good one too, but not the same one. We are having our problems tonight. This is Carl Jackson, The Little Mountain Church. And we do have connection problems here.
There's a little mountain.
This is Carl Jackson, A Little Mountain
Church. In my thoughts of yesterday, where friends and family gathered for the Lord. There an old-fashioned preacher off the straight and narrow way, for what few coins a congregation could afford. Dressed in all our Sunday best, we sat on pews of solid oak, and I remember how our voices filled the air. How Mama sounded like an angel on those high soprano notes. So when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. All-day Sunday singings and dinner on the ground, many were the souls that were revived. While the brothers and the sisters who'd gone on to glory land slept in peace in the maple grove nearby. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. In that little mountain church house, I first heard the word I based my life upon. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house, I first heard the word I based my life upon.
Carl Jackson and Little Mountain Church House. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Here's another religious song by Jimmy Fortune, and this is The Far Side Banks of Jordan. This is a song made very popular back in the mid-1970s by Johnny and June Carter Cash, and very, very popular recording. And this is the version by Jimmy Fortune. Quite a great, good gospel song, a gospel song and a love song, I'd say.
I believe my steps are growing wearier each day. Still, I've got a journey on my mind. Lures of this old world have ceased to make me wanna stay, and my one regret is leaving you behind. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. If it proves to be his will that I am first to cross, somehow I've a feeling it will be. When it comes your time to travel, likewise don't feel lost, for I will be the first one that you'll see. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. Through this life, we've labored hard to earn our meager fame. It's brought us trembling hands and failing eyes. I'll just rest here on this shore and turn my eyes away until you come, then we'll see paradise. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand.
That's Jimmy Fortune. Great old gospel song, Far Side Banks of Jordan. There's another song I hope you'll like. This is a song here by Daly, and screen's got it wrong today. We do have our problems. Anyway, this is Rhonda Vincent and Gene Watson, Gone for Good. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Rhonda Vincent and Gene Watson, Gone for Good. As soon as our very slow internet connection can call this tune up for us, this is with Rhonda Vincent and Gene Watson.
You used to kiss me every afternoon when you walked through the door. You'd smile and tell me all about your day, but you don't do that anymore.
We no longer take the time to talk the way we should. If we keep letting things go bad, they'll soon be gone for good. What's not going on? is tearing us apart.
Building a wall of doubt that stands between us.
It's time understood.
If we keep letting things go bad, they'll soon be gone for good. Reach out and touch me in the middle of the night. Now we sleep facing different walls. Silent wars are hard to fight.
And that's just what can happen. And I was so afraid it would. If we keep letting things go bad, they'll soon be gone for good.
What's not going on here is tearing us apart.
Building a wall of doubt that's lost between our hearts.
We can't go on like this forever. It's time we understood. And we keep letting things go bad, they'll soon be gone.
Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show's repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I will sign off tonight as I always do.
The show's phenomenal.
This is the best.
We do have our problems. So sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, The Maple Leaf Forever, played by the Pipe and Drums Band of Canada's famous 48th Highlanders. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio.com.